Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will explore further where we stand with the EU energy sanctions towards Russia and an update on our previous conversations on the overall response of the European energy system to the need to cut our dependency from Russian gas and oil. We will discuss this with our senior scholars, Simone Tagliapietra and Georg Zachmann, who are following very closely the situation here at Bruegel. Hi, Georg and Simone, how are you?
Hello, busy day, but all good.
Georg?
Yeah, good morning. Hi, Giuseppe.
During the European Council on the 30th of May, the EU leader struck a deal to ban most Russian oil imports, and they seek to deprive Russia's President Vladimir Putin of revenues to fund his war in Ukraine. The agreement includes exemption for supplies via pipeline to bring Hungary on board specifically. Also, the agreement will not be enforced before the end of 2022. We have seen in the past weeks the EU difficulty in delivering these energy sanctions against Russia, and some countries have been moving to open the ruble account for gas, and the situation before the European Council was even pointing to some sort of stalemate when it was coming to negotiations and so on. So on one hand, we can say that we can welcome the fact that the European Council took a decision. On the other end, I think that there are quite some elements that allows us to make a critical assessment of the agreement that was reached. So in this episode, we are going to start with that, because this is the big news since the last conversations we've been having on this topic. And I would like to ask both of you, Simone and Georg, to give us a bit more of an in-depth overview about this agreement that was reached and how did we got there. And then after that, I would like to go more in-depth into these more critical points and dividing lines and dissect a bit what's going on at the moment. I don't know who would like to start and kick off. Simone, would you like to?
Yes, thanks, Giuseppe. I think what we have seen at the European Council certainly doesn't represent the perfect deal. But under the current circumstances, it certainly represents an important step in the right direction. Let's all recall that up to 2 months ago, it was even impossible to discuss, sanctions on oil. This is really a step that brings the European action to sanction Russia to the next level, so to the core of the dependencies of Europe, which are, of course, oil and gas. And therefore, this is an important step. Now, we can all see that the major weakness of this deal relates to the timing. So for 6 months, Europe will keep buying Russian oil. We know that this comes at around $20 billion per month. So we are still going to fund Russia for months to come. But it is also true that countries have the opportunity to freely phase down or phase out their buys of Russian oil even before the end of the year. And as of January next year, Europe will basically stop importing Russian oil, because at the end of the day, the exemption really will apply mainly to Hungary, because, for example, Germany and Poland have already said that they are going to stop the imports of oil by the end of the year in any case.
Georg?
I think I would second Simone on that it is an important step. So first, the EU was able to engineer unanimity on sanctions. And I think it's an important political signal to say, okay, it's now the sixth package and it's getting more difficult, but the EU was again able to show to Russia that we stand together on the sanctioning side. But there are some scars, I think, also politically to be taken from that. So I'm not sure how quickly a seventh sanction package will be drawn up, but for now the unity holds. What I find quite important is that Germany quite substantially contributed to that. And I think in the political discussions we've been having over Germany's role in the sanctioning and in the support to Ukraine, it is quite a strong signal that that Germany accepted that the northern part of the Druzhba pipeline is going to be stopped as well, which means that quite some cost will come to German oil consumers in terms of replacing that that oil. Then I also think that it exceeded somewhat expectations on some elements. So there are, I mean, we had the discussions before on what is going to be included in the package, and there were, for example, questions around oil products, and oil products seem to be in, which is a significant part of Russian oil and oil product exports, so a significant share of their revenues. And there seems also to be in that insurance on the transportation of oil will be sanctioned in the future, which might make it a bit more difficult, or maybe substantially more difficult, we'll see how well this is going to be implemented, for Russia also to export oil to other parts of the world, which makes the embargo more biting. So overall, my take would be it's an instrument that we will be able to build on. I always see sanctions as a sort of whack-a-mole. So they always try to find ways around the sanctions, and we always have to readjust our means and to kind of make it difficult for Russia to export oil and oil products to us and our partner countries. But we will be able to do that. A bit of promotion. I mean, on the Bruegel website, we have a tracker of Russian oil exports. So there you can see essentially to which parts of the world oil is being exported. We see that still a lot of the Russian exports go to Europe. And we will be able to monitor in the coming weeks and months how that might change and whether it's really possible to substantially depress the amount of oil Russia's able to export.
Thank you, Georg. On this, I have a follow-up question because, of course, also to make our listeners understanding a bit more, we are really at the beginning of the analysis of the impact of those sanctions. So it's very important to go step by step and understand exactly what do they mean. One aspect is that not the pipeline oil is temporary, not included in this package. It means that it's only seaborne crude which is included. And on this, the question is, I mean, provocative or not really provocative, like you can argue that seaborne crude is the one that is probably the easiest to be redirected to other markets because the boats can just change their route and be redirected somewhere else. Also, one can argue that Russia has more than 6 months ahead of themselves in order to be able to cut deals and reroute those boats. Is that correct?
It is indeed correct that at the beginning we will focus on seaborne oil, but my understanding is that at least half of the pipeline exports will also be relatively quickly phased out because the Druzhba pipeline, which is the Russian oil export pipeline to Europe, has two branches, one southern and one northern branch. And the northern branch that goes to Poland and East Germany will be stopped based on essentially unilateral action by Poland and Germany. So that only leaves the southern branch of the Druzhba pipeline, which goes to Slovakia and Hungary. And let's see what the Slovaks are going to do with that. The Hungarians said they want to continue to import it. So commission official on Twitter said that about 90% of the Russian oil exports will fall under the embargo in at the end of the year, which is quite substantial. Now, will Russia be able to export this oil and the oil products elsewhere? Yes and no. So, I mean, seaborne, as you said, it's possible to send the tankers elsewhere, but all other markets are quite far away. The major export infrastructure of Russia is very much targeted on Europe. So the big oil exporting ports that are connected to the oil fields are two in the Baltic Sea, and getting out of the Baltic Sea, it's very easy to get to Europe, but getting out of the Baltic Sea, it's quite a distance to go to Asia. So you might count some 40 or more days to go to Asia. You might need some 5 to 8 days to get to Europe. So you might need about 5 times more ships and tankers. You might need 5 times more crews. And on top of that, it might become quite a challenge if you don't get insurance for that to get those. And if we see that there's a big issue, then maybe one can reopen the question of whether Greek shipping companies are still being allowed to rent out their ships to Russian exports. But for that, I mean, time is also on our side. I mean, we can see and observe, and as I said, it's a bit of a whack-a-mole. If we see that something that they found a very easy way out, then we might be able to close that as well. So I am relatively convinced that we might be able to frustrate a significant amount of Russian oil exports with the current measures. Indeed, my main problem, as we all said, is that the timing is a bit unfortunate. It would be better to start earlier than at the end of the year. But by the end of the year, I think it will become effective to a significant degree.
Another, let's say, a critical remark that I've been reading on the Financial Times was the risk of distorting competition in the EU oil market. The Financial Times, I'm quoting it, says that the partial ban risks distorting competition in the EU oil market, with refineries connected to pipelines from Russia enjoying a price advantage. The price of Russian oil has fallen sharply as European traders have shunned the country's seaborne crude. That's the quote from the article, as those are the first analysis that have been written over the deal. And of course, more analysis will come from you on Bruegel very soon as well. So what do we make out of this remark?
I think one of the key issues at stake while providing exemptions to certain countries is indeed to cope with this fragmentation that is being created. So if Hungary is given the opportunity to keep importing Russian oil and to then allow its refineries to continue to work with Russian crude, countries that have, for example, Russian-owned refineries in their countries, for example, in Italy, Priolo, and in other countries, similar situations, there is a problem that now the government will have to deal with these and find ways to keep these refineries operating even without Russian crude. These companies cannot buy from anywhere else because of the sanctions that have been applied on banks. They cannot get, therefore, the oil from the usual supplies. They can only use Russian crude oil. Now that the embargo will come into force, they will not be able to process that either. So countries will have to think about nationalizing these assets in order to preserve energy security, but also to ensure jobs.
Thank you so much. In the meantime, I have to say, this is the surprises of recording a podcast the day after the European Council has been having the deal. I have the pleasure to have Luis Garicano, who is vice chair of the Renew group at the European Parliament, to join us as a guest to our conversation. For the sake, because we are already within our conversation quite in. Hello, Luis, how are you?
Hello, Giuseppe. Apologies, we had just a group meeting that went over. Well, it was scheduled, so sorry about that.
It's perfectly fine. We started to record, and we're very happy that you managed to join us while we were discussing. We just, also for our listeners to recap, we just had a very initial feedback and recap of what has been the deal that the European Council reached on the oil embargo, and we were attempting a first analysis of the risks and the critical points of this, notwithstanding also the strength of the political statement that such a deal reached overnight on the 30th of May is representing. So without no further ado, actually, Georg and Simone might excuse for interrupting the flow of the conversation we were having before, I would like to ask your opinion about the deal. What do you think, and which are your critical points? Maybe they are similar to the ones we were discussing before, but I think this is going to be an interesting input to our conversation.
Yes, thank you. Just to tell your listeners and also all of you that we have one of the biggest votes of the legislature next week with all the package of the Green Deal, from ETS to CBAM to forestries to cars, CO2, the ban on cars, etc. So that's what we are right now trying to finalize. It's going to be very, very complex. So I will keep you updated on that, but that's going to be a big, big deal. It's probably the most important legislature piece of legislation we're going to pass in this term. On yesterday, I would say I'm not entirely negative, let's say it like this. I saw Georg's and Simone's answers and initial reactions on Twitter, so I'm not totally unfamiliar with what they think. I think that it could have been worse. Hungary was really blackmailing us and asking for money. So they're not getting money, but it could have been much better. And the reason that I am kind of not fully on board with the enthusiasm that is felt across many instances in Europe is because it's twofold. One is the stuff that really we take out. The oil that we really take out of the global oil market is the key. And yes, we increase the price for Russia to kind of circle the globe, taking their oil somewhere. But as long as the pipeline is open, that is really the place where we have, there are no substitutes. And the gas, the oil that comes by pipeline, which is, I think, and Georg can correct me because he knows the numbers much better, but it's around 1 out of 3 million barrels per day that we import. As long as that's flowing, then the damage to Russia is very contained, in my opinion. Also, the damage to us. I mean, this is the thing of trade, right? If it's a fixed structure, is more painful to replace for both sides. In that sense, I would say I think, and I've been pushing for weeks. I put every day the oil tankers coming into Europe. Yesterday, oil tankers worth €1 billion landed in Europe, so docked in Europe. So it's good that that's not going to happen. It's good that those tankers are not going to dock from Russia. But I think that the damage is contained for Russia because gas is still flowing normally and oil by pipeline is still flowing normally. And I think those are the two elements that Russia, if I was Russia, I would want to protect them. And they can still know that their energy exporting industries damaged by a life, let's say. They will have to find ways to export this oil, but the market for oil is a global market and they can do that.
So that's exactly the kind of things we were exploring a minute ago. And since Simone and Georg were reacting to my questions on that, I would like to ask if they have an additional reaction to what you just said, and I see that Georg would like to intervene.
Yeah, I would actually have a question to you, Luis. And I mean, we were thinking about what the next steps could be, and as we expressed earlier on, I think it's it's an instrument to be built on. It's, in my view, it's politically good that we managed to get an agreement, and it's better than no agreement, and it's not completely empty. It's so it it could have been significantly worse. So it's not purely symbolic. Now, my understanding is that politically, it seems to now take time a bit to digest for the council the current sanction package and before moving further. So do you think there will be a window of opportunity coming up in the next weeks and months to already start tightening the screws, or will we have to wait until end of summer or so until this discussion can come back, because politically everybody seems exhausted at that moment?
I think you're very right. Right, the Prime Minister of Belgium this morning says, "Well, leave me alone. Don't bring me more. Don't bring me more packages." I will do my best from where I am to get the momentum going for the seventh package with gas and with the pipelines. I think many of us will be pushing for that. I'm sure Verhofstadt and many others in Parliament. You're right that they're exhausted, but I mean, the ones who are really exhausted are the Ukrainians, and they are really suffering right now. Very, very heavy bombardments and artillery barrages. That's where we should put our sympathy and not elsewhere. The truth is that by postponing and enlarging the periods all the time, so now this oil is until the end of the year, etc., we are letting Putin finance this war. And I think that, to me, the point that I try to get across, and I know it's hard, is that a short war where he doesn't have the finance to continue is one where he wants to settle, is one where actually inflation and all these other things that our leaders are rightly concerned are less long-lasting, where we have a good chance of stopping the economic damage. So for me, it's better to do our best fast up front, try to get Russia to be weakened, than prolonging all this pain just because we are not able to face it. So my position would be, let's really do more fast, and I will do my best to push. But you're right that it does sound like they want to try to avoid that kind of pressure.
Simone.
Yeah, of course, I think that both you, Luis, from the political side, and we at Bruegel from the more academic side have been pushing the idea of the tariff on oil and gas. But indeed, the political momentum for that might not materialize likely over the next weeks. But one important element that I think we need to bring into the conversation at this point is also what's next from Russia. Typically, when there are sanctions, there are retaliations. And I think now the question is, what should we be expecting from Russia? Will Russia retaliate on oil, potentially deciding to unplug supplies over the next weeks, months, so before the embargo actually enters into force, since they have lost the European market in any case? So to try to provide us with significant damages, or will Russia retaliate on gas? I mean, we have already seen that Bulgaria, Poland, Finland, the Netherlands, Denmark soon are soon to be cut off from Russian gas supplies. We know that other companies are starting to pay according to the ruble scheme, so far so good for them, but this might change. So I think the important question now is to see what will come from Moscow as a retaliation, and for us, how are we getting prepared to face these potential retaliations? And the key question there, which is also part of the discussion at the Council, is what do we do with RepowerEU? We have this huge package that the Commission has managed to put forward in a very short period of time, that tries to use all the possible instruments to also get prepared in case of an emergency. And I think that was one of the biggest differences between the final, let's say, package and the first proposal of March. I think particularly at the European, at the EU energy platform, will member states really make use of this instrument to become an important tool to manage a situation of emergency, for the storage refilling that we need to do before the next winter, for the coordination of the dispatch of gas across European countries in case of a disruption, etc. So what's your feeling, Luis, about this? Do you think we are in the right on the right path to basically have a more resilient position also vis-a-vis what can be the retaliations, or what are the bottlenecks you see, if I may ask you?
Thank you. On the retaliation, I hope they do. I am very depressed about the whole not paying in rubles story, right? We see who's actually being strong and who isn't, by who's getting cut from gas. And basically, many key countries such as Germany and Italy are whistling themselves out of this commitment not to get paid in rubles. And actually, the Commission has given them a blueprint on how to avoid their own sanctions, which is kind of really amazing. As Hanno Lustig, an economist, was saying in Twitter, he was saying something like, look, you don't need expensive lawyers. The Commission is going to tell you how to avoid their own sanctions on rubles. So this is bad. I mean, I think that Europe has said they wouldn't be paying rubles, and they're accepting that, and that is bad. We will see today, indeed, a couple of other countries being cut off. Denmark, apparently, in particular, and it's true that, I mean, Russia is doing a smart game here, which is the countries that are small, it doesn't cost, it's like pour encourager les autres, right? You're going after Bulgaria, which is just 1 million BCMs. You kill gas to Bulgaria, and you sold Germany, which is the real big deal, that they shouldn't play with you. So I think that this kind of game suggests, Simone, and I would love to hear what you and Jörg think, but I think it suggests that Russia is being rational about this. And if they're being rational, the retaliation is not going to be, in my opinion, unqualified across the board. It's always going to be, who is the weakest link here? Who can we go after? And let's twist the screws on that particular weak link. So I wouldn't see at this point Russia just saying, okay, now there's no gas to Europe, because that's going to hurt them more than it hurts more. But can they kind of find a way to retaliate to some particular countries, cut off some small country that they don't mind so much? Yes, because at the end of the day, remember, and you guys know this prices much better than me, but they're actually earning more each time they're cutting somebody, and the prices go all the way up. So it's not even costly, right? So I think my answer would be, Simone, rational retaliation from Russia is to be expected, and that means retaliation that doesn't make them worse off, and that makes one member of our coalitions kind of significantly worse off, but no retaliation that affects the entire market. So kind of everything that is saber rattling and raises prices is something that I would be expecting.
Thank you, Luis. I would like, because we are already past the mark of almost half an hour of our discussion. So I will pass to a second aspect, which you already mentioned, which is the broader aspect. You know, you mentioned the Repower EU in general. I would say the need of solidarity within EU in general, in case of an interruption of Russian gas that Simone has been pointing out, but in general, you know, like the broader situation, the broader aspects of how, let's say, in the medium to long term, the overall mix of energy and or the overall interaction and cooperation between the different national markets should integrate further in order to face the challenges that we are going to have, which are not going to be necessarily less, even within the frame of, let's say, resolution of the conflict at some point. Simone and Georg have been writing quite a lot about it, so perhaps they can add a bit more on the framing of this before passing the word to you, Louis, and hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I think it's a good transition because what Louis said on kind of this targeted approach of Russian counter-sanction, that makes a lot of sense to expect that, and trying to essentially undermine the solidarity within Europe, divide and rule, has always been a strategy in the past. And Europe has shown that it is always trying to find very, very narrow balances in terms of implementing sanctions. So it really invites the other side to find a way to unbalance the finely tuned balance that the Europeans have initially found. And therefore, in my view, it would be extremely important to find solidarity mechanisms on the European side that can kind of help us to protect ourselves against these divide and rule strategies. And something that we have been doing with Simone and a couple of other economists in the past weeks is developing a scheme for some sort of mutualization of the gas crisis cost, and making sure that the allocation of gas among member states is functioning even in a crisis situation. And what we were thinking about was a full cut of Russian supplies, but actually it's even more powerful if there's only partial cut, because in such a situation the current proposals, in my view, fall a bit short, because the current proposal is more that we stop the market in a crisis situation. Everybody is essentially sitting on its storages, and those that are well prepared have the gas, and otherwise there is this list of companies or a kind of a list of consumers that still get the gas. But I'm not sure whether we will see a French glass manufacturer being forced to reduce production in order to help a Bulgarian grandma. And I just, If we stop the market, if we just let it be done by this political negotiations of who gets the gas, I think it's going to be extremely divisive between member states. So our proposal would be more in line with trying to find a way that we jointly procure some gas into storage that then is allocated based on price signals still, which would help us to make sure that those countries that don't have the gas might be able to buy it.
Simone, you wanted to add something on this?
Yeah, just a very quick follow-up on what Georg said about the need for more action at the national level, because if you look at the REPowerEU package, you indeed see that ultimately the key decisions will have to be taken at the national level, both in terms of to which extent to coordinate with other countries, European countries, and ensure solidarity, but also what kind of important actions we can take in order to make our position vis-a-vis Russia more resilient, particularly ahead of next winter. And there I notably think at demand reduction. So far, we haven't seen sufficient action by governments to try to foster behavioral change and reduce consumption of gas, electricity, and oil. This is a key issue. I think there is too much complacency across Europe. We don't feel like we are in a situation of emergency, as we actually are and might literally be in at any time, because we don't know what's going to happen with our supplies over the next months. And what we have seen at Bruegel, we also have a data set tracking these measures. No, we see governments pulling billions into artificially lowering energy bills for all, or even the fuel prices. We see since September, big countries like Spain, Italy, France, Germany pulling 20, 30 billion into this business of lowering energy prices, which doesn't make sense to be done in a universal manner. This is the worst policy we can adopt now because it is regressive, because it doesn't help from an energy security perspective, and because it's simply bad policy. So when will governments finally become more targeted in their action to support the most vulnerable citizens, as they should be supported, but then realize that high energy prices will at this very moment be part have to be part of the solution in order to lower demand, to make our position more resilient vis-a-vis the next winter, namely? I think this is going to be extremely important as well. So on the one hand is what Georg said about mutualization and ensuring solidarity, but on the other hand, we also need to take difficult decision at the national level that so far politicians have been struggling to take.
Thank you, Simone. And I would like to ask a reaction from Louis. And after that, we might have to go towards the conclusion of our conversation.
No, it's very much in the same line of Georg and Simone. I've been shocked by the policy reactions in Europe that Simone was describing now. 30 cents in Germany, 20 cents in Spain are being paid by the government of gasoline. So it's actually not only not an embargo, it's actually increasing the demand for these fossil fuels. We are subsidizing demand, we're increasing demand in the moment where the supply is scarce. So we are actually increasing the tensions in the market. This is a terrible, terrible policy. Simone is right. It's kind of strange, right? Because it's like, okay, we want to fight climate change. Oh, we wish that prices were higher, so there was less CO2. Prices are higher, instead of saying like, oh, great. It just proves that all that we have been saying about climate change was wrong, because now that prices are higher, we say like, oh, no, we don't like higher prices. We're going to subsidize prices. So it's been bad policy. Unsustainable. I mean, hey, Germany can spend these enormous sums of money, as Simone was describing, tens of billions to subsidize gasoline in terms of affordability. I don't think Spain can. Spain, all this money could be used in many other better ways. Bad policy, not very sustainable economically, but also not sustainable in terms of the market process over the next few months. So yes, on resilience, we need to change internal policies, but we also, I mean, Georg was making a very, very important point, which is we don't really have an energy single market. And we don't really know how all these allocations will happen once we get in trouble over the next winter. Obviously a free for all, every man for himself kind of situation, or every person for themselves, is really not conducive to good outcomes. It could cause real serious political tensions. That proposal by Bruegel and by Kerry and Simone in terms of trying to have centralized mechanisms that are price driven, it seems like to me like a very, very good proposal, and I would support it. I don't think Europe is quite there yet, in spite of the Repower EU. Noise.
Thank you, Louis. And obviously, we are going to keep having conversations around this topic, because it's not going away, unfortunately. And also, Georg and Simone, as I was mentioning before, will keep writing about it. So I invite all our listeners to keep an eye to our website, www.bruegel.org, in which all our analysis are available on open source. I would like to thank once again Luis for joining us as a guest for this podcast, and thank you Simone and Georg as well for your insight.
Thank you, Luis. Thank you all.
Thank you all. Thank you, Giuseppe. And it's great to be here. And Bruegel is doing a great job on this question. So I'm pleased to be back.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. And also thanks to all our listeners for tuning in and listen to the Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.